Responsible is going to take over at this point. He's going to introduce all of our speakers and tell us a little bit about them and a little bit about what we're going to be hearing.
That is so. All right, give me that microphone.
Here, why don't you, and then we pass it around.
I got a little short changed on the microphone. Yeah, okay, I'll change these back with you later on. Hey, this is the first time in my life I have ever had the pleasure of being in the same room with these three guys at the same time. What they don't know ain't worth knowing. Cristobal Diaz, the man who has done for Cuban discography what Brian Rust and Alan DeBus have done in other important areas, is someone I have known for almost 20 years. Jerry Plano at RCA, when I was first working on the ethnic music on record, said, hey, here's a guy that wants to know about so-and-so, and I looked at this letter, and even with the amount of Spanish I can read, which is pretty pitiful, I could see that here was somebody who was on to something, and I was going to do whatever I could do for him, because there were a few things that I had in mind for him to do for me. And that has happened a thousandfold over the years. Chris Strachwitz to my right, I mean, you know, I go back to the days when I was a Strachwitz fan off of those Big Joe Williams and Mance Lipscomb and Clifton Chenier recordings. Chris has covered so much of the vernacular musical universe, not simply studying it and producing a handful of field recordings a la Mr. Lomax, our subject of the last hour, but Chris has published and disseminated, and I think there is no means of preservation as good as dissemination. Chris Strachwitz's huge catalog of the last nearly 40 years bears witness to the fact that he has been one of the greatest music producers of the century, I think, in this country. He has fearlessly explored musical areas that only his own wonderful ear has allowed him to hear, and to publish it for the rest of us. And if something sold 200 or 300 copies, you know, be damned. He heard the music, he heard its worth, and if it's taken the rest of us a little while to catch up, that was okay with him. Clifton Chenier's records made up the difference. Ted Beardsley, I have never gotten to spend nearly enough time with. Ted is much more cognizant of this wonderful area of overlap that Latin music, especially Caribbean Latin music, as opposed to Chris Strachwitz's broad knowledge of Southwestern American, Northern Mexican music. Ted's expertise covers this wonderful area where American popular music has picked up elements of Latin music and put them together and fused something different out of them. Ted was after me when Emore was in publication, that I really ought to be putting in certain records by Javier Cugat and Charlie Barnett and Duke Ellington, and anything that contained a positive Latin element deserved a place in the discography. And my response always was, of course, that's a wonderful idea. You do it. Ted is. What did I do? The sound is gone. What, should I holler? All right. Well, everybody's a crit. What, did you turn off the switch? Probably.
Or is the switch on top?
Yeah, there we go.
I am the high-tech kid. You better believe it. So I wasn't sure whether we were going to see all three of our panelists today, and I had planned a little extempore myself, talking about the wonderful area that recording Spanish language music in this hemisphere got started, and I will truncate that to about 30 seconds. Briefly, you know that that it was very important as the early record makers carved up the world that Victor and Columbia, whose purview took into account the entire New World, North and South and Central America, and the lands in between, were to get into the Spanish language market very, very quickly, and so they did. Edison's operation got to Mexico City as early as 1904. Victor's Xonophone division went to Havana in 1905, along with a curious little trip that took them to Honolulu, to Shanghai, and to Buenos Aires. Records survive from all of these areas on the single-sided Xonophones. It's a puzzle we haven't mapped out yet. Columbia was in Havana by 1906, the Victor label itself by 1907, and after that the record team spread out all over Central and South America. Ironically, not doing the same thing for the hillbillies and the African Americans in our own country until the 1920s. Too bad that they didn't have the same foresight. But anyway, these gentlemen will talk about various aspects of this, as well as the areas that that they have been working in themselves. I am going to start with the gentleman on my left, mainly because he and I need to reverse the ballet so I can give him back the microphone. Cristobal Diaz Ayala has published, I'm unfortunately too often by himself at his own expense, several wonderful volumes, including the discography that I've mentioned, that document the Cuban music history of the past century, the discography, and even an entire volume of these wonderful street vendor songs called Pregones. But I think that's not a topic for today. But if you need books and you're interested in Cuban music, his publications are indispensable. I'll take my cut after the show, Cristobal. Thank you.
Well, I hope you will be able to follow my broken English. Anyway, I have my translator side by side. Since its beginning, the American recording industry took a keen interest in the market provided by ethnic groups forming the melting pot of New America as potential customers. After all, the first bestseller of the new media had been an unknown tenor, Enrico Caruso. As quoted in Ethnic Recordings, an introduction by Pica Grono, in 1909, the Columbia Phonograph Company urged its dealers in the company's house organ to remember that in all large cities and in most towns, there are sections where people of one nationality or another congregate in colonies. Most of these people keep up the habits and prefer to speak the language of the old country. Speak to them in their own tongue, if you can, and see their faces light up with a smile that linger and hear the strike of language they will give you in reply. To these people, records in their own language have an irresistible attraction, and they will buy them readily. And again, 2 years later, don't wait until you have sold every American-born individual in your locality, a Columbia, before giving the one-time foreigner attention. You will probably find a good deal of much easier business among the people of foreign nationality. But those dealers soon found out that in order to convince foreigners into buying the new talking machines or phonographs, you have to offer them some of their own music. That's why pioneers companies such as Edison, Victor, Sonophone, and Columbia launched very early an ethnic recording program that, thanks God, was documented in Dick Spotwood's 7 volumes Ethnic Music on Records, 1893 to 1942, published in 1990. They started using the foreign talent living in the States, but very soon, at the very beginning of the century, they were sending recording teams by the nearby Caribbean and Mexico. As a just-born industry, the recording one encountered many problems to be solved, but the foreign market has some of their own, main one being the language, a mystery for the recording personnel. Gronow mentioned before tell us that when Columbia engineers recorded the Cajun accordionist Dewey Segura in New Orleans in 1929, they told him, "We don't know what you are singing. We ask you just one thing. Don't sing anything dirty." Actually, Caribbean musicians did not sing dirty in these early recordings, but certainly they sang some bizarre things. For example, they sang in African languages mixed with Spanish in many sones, like in this one by Sexteto Bologna recorded in New York, 1926, A la Cuata y Co. I believe you have this sheet that have been spread around. Okay, you can follow the lyrics. Had this been recorded by a Cuban recording corporation, most certainly it would have been censored. But at that time, it was prohibited to use other language than Spanish in holidays and scenes. But Cuban government did not dare to prohibit the circulation of a Brunswick record. More liberties were taken by the hillbilly Cuban singers or guajiros in their puntos guajiros. This venue is probably the oldest original Cuban music, dating from the 18th century. In its 10-line verses, they deal with love to the woman, the family, or the country, but also during Spanish domination against the political situation or praising Cuban patriots. As such, it was one form of protest song. After Cuban independence in 1902, the punto will criticize Cuban governments, and since there have been an American intervention from 1898 to 1902 and a second one in 1904, they will also criticize the American government's attitude, like in this punto recorded in 1906 by Antonio Morejon in an Edison cylinder. Alza la vista al oriente, raise your view to the east. Let's hear the second decima, and you will have the translation also in that sheet of paper.
Son los pensamientos del gobierno interventor.
non-communication scheme was also used by many Puerto Rican musicians recording in New York patriotic songs regarding the island's political status. Probably the companies sooner or later did find out what was going on and let it go on account of the democratic tradition of the United States. Thus, what might have been a cultural limitation was indeed a way for dozens of ethnics to perpetuate an important segment of their musical heritage. Indeed, culture was not in the minds of the recording industry moguls, but fortunately, that was an important byproduct of this 1078. On this ethnic records program, the manufacturers have some questions already answered. Why they have to record? To sell talking machines and records to these people. When? As soon as possible. Where? In the States, if possible, or anywhere else. How? With the equipment available or portable ones in the case of overseas recordings. But they still have two questions to solve. What and who to record? At those times, there were not an art executives. Perhaps, fortunately, I hope there is not any one of them here today. So most probably, scouting the talent was left to the ethnic merchants distributing the phonographs of Edison, Victor, Columbia, or whatever. At least that's the way it was with Victor in Cuba, with Humara y Lastra Corporation, a general store that was their distributor. Probably the artists themselves choose what to record. And judging by the results, the system worked pretty good. Especially in the case of Puerto Rico, the system worked marvelously. In 1910 and 17, two recording trips were made by Columbia and Victor, respectively, to San Juan, Puerto Rico. At that time, popular music in Puerto Rico, favored by dominant white class, was of European origin, such as Paso Doble, Two Step, Waltz, Mazurka, Polka, and Danza. But this last one has Afro-Caribbean influence. Seis, Bomba, and Plena, although played by popular classes, was seldom heard outside their own ambiance. Consequently, of the 105 Columbia recordings published, 77 were dances, and 13 polkas, pasodobles, etc., are only 6 seis. Same happened with the 50 Victor numbers, 17 danzas, 8 Escolar songs, 11 European venues, and only 2 seis. On 1917, by means of the Jones Act, the American citizenship was granted to the Puerto Ricans, and a great immigration of poor farmers took place mainly to New York and other places. By the 20s, a sizable population of Puerto Ricans were working in the Big Apple. As this community grew, and also their economic means, some money was available for recreation purposes. So not only farmers, but also musicians decided to leave San Juan and move to New York. By the mid-20s, a humble colony of Puerto Ricans was able to support their own entertainment. They were solvent enough to hold parties, dances, and buy phonographs and records. They were a market for recording companies. And good musicians as Pedro Flores, Rafael Hernandez, and others stayed in New York. It was only natural that they started recording for both in and out Puerto Ricans, but especially for those in New York just like them. Since there was not a dominant Puerto Rican class to tell them what to record, there was a dramatic change in the public's preferences. By 1922, the first plena and the first bomba were recorded. Seis was also used, and also some Cuban venues, such as danzón, guaracha, song, and bolero, adapted to Puerto Rican style. Few danzas were recorded. In the following years, same trend was followed in Puerto Rico, and thus a complete change initiated in New York took place in Puerto Rican popular music. I wonder if that could have happened if New York and if recording studios have not been available. Other problem the engineers had to face in Havana in the first recording trips was the band's compositions. While complete segregation was the rule for American bands at that time, quite the opposite happened in the Caribbean, especially in Cuba, where music guild has been almost, since colonization, dominated by Cubans of African origins. So when the Sonophone engineers arrived at Havana in 1905, probably they had quite a surprise to encounter many Afro-Cuban groups and orchestras were blacks, and worst of all, race-mixed orchestras. Same happened to Edison and Columbia that arrived in 1906 and Victory in 1907. Mainly, the orquestas típicas, typical orchestras, composed of at least 10 musicians, which played mostly danzones, were a black and white mixture. The American engineers did not probably notice it, but they were making musical history. As pointed out by Dick Spottwoods in his notes to the CD, The Cuban Danzón, edited by Chris Trochwitz, numerous danzones were recorded during the earliest recording trips to Havana in 1905-6, even though the emerging technology had only been capable of capturing orchestral music on records for a few years. In New York, dance music on records was performed by a small contingent from military bands or house musicians who crowd uncomfortably around Buck Recording's horns, grinding out hits of the day. Cuban orchestras típicas were among the first independent working ensembles to make records. Not until more than a decade later, when the original Dixieland Jazz Band and Paul Whiteman Orchestra brought their distinctive sounds to the record market, did the industry begin to realize the value of so-called name bands with distinctive sounds and a performing existence outside the studios. That closed the Dick Spottwood side. But the original Dixieland Jazz Band and Paul Whiteman's were white musicians groups. Ironically, Afro-Americans had to wait still a few years to have access to the recording studios, but Afro-Cubans had that opportunity back in 1905, granted by the same American recording industry. But there is more about these orchestras típicas and its danzones. On the CD above mentioned, the Cuba Danzón, which have a very suggestive subtitle, Before There Was Jazz, its editor Chris Strachwitz pointed out in the liners the similarity of the instrumental format of the Orquesta Típica, created at least by 1870, and the New Orleans jazz bands in the making at the beginning of this century, with a front line of cornet, trombone, and clarinet. In the same liners, Spottwood also mentioned that the three most important Cuban orchestras típicas that did the recordings from 1905 to 1907 had a cornetist as their leader, as was the case in the New Orleans ensembles in the majority of the cases. Quizzed by the similitude, Strachwitz asked New Orleans music researcher Jack Stewart to contribute some comments about the connection between these two musical traditions. Those comments, too long for the CD booklet, can be found, however, in the Arhuli catalog website. In his scholarly essay, Stewart delved into the similarities and coincidences of both musics, but he did not consider this a striking similarity of a trio composed of cornet, trombone, and clarinet, which, as in the classic concerto grosso form, plays among themselves with the rest of the orchestra as a background, with the cornet usually as the leader, with the other two instruments playing counter melodies, harmonies, or other musical embellishments. But this very same principle has been used at least since 1870 by Cuban orchestras típicas. Let's hear one of the classic numbers recorded by the original Dixieland band in 1917, Sensation Rack. Now, let's hear a fragment of a danzón recorded in 1907 at Havana by orchestra Felipe Valdez, Alza Columbia. Try not to pay attention to the rhythm patterns or syncopations, which are, of course, very different from the ones used in Dixieland. Let's concentrate on the combining sounds of these three instruments. They are intermingled, this humorous and playful interchange so kind to Dixieland. Black regiments fought in Cuba during the Hispanic-American War, 1898. There always have been a close link between Havana and New Orleans, and those danzones recordings should have reached the latter by 1910. Here rests my case, and I pass the query to you. Would it be possible that the instrumental trio format of Dixieland took some inspiration from the Cuban danzón? To sum it up, the early and vast presence of American recording industry in the Caribbean and South America, aside from the economical motivations of such practice, created an unrestrained, free, and enormous flow of venues, styles, composers, musicians, and artists, especially in the three first decades of the century, that made thousands of records, living testimony of the culture of many countries. And then Dick Spotwoods, with his ethnic discography, gave us the treasure map to find, study, and divulge this heritage. Thanks to him, and thanks to you for your patience.